100 years ago this month, the Wright brothers were squirreled away in a little shed at Kill Devil Hills in North Carolina. They were starting to put together the machine they hoped would allow them to be the first men to fly. But they weren't the only ones with that dream. In the race for flight, a number of inventors were nipping at the brothers' heels. Over the next few months, we will present profiles of some of the Wrights' main rivals. Their chief competitor was Samuel Pierpont Langley. As secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, Langley was one of the most esteemed scientists in the country and the only person whose effort to fly was supported with government money. James Tobin is the author of To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight. He says Samuel Langley wanted to ensure his place in science history.
Langley had achieved prominence as an astronomer, but decided at about the age of 50 that he was not going to achieve as an astronomer his goal of becoming really one of the great figures in the history of science. And so, at great risk to his career and his personal reputation, he decided to look at the question of flying machines, which at the time was something pursued by only a few individuals, serious individuals around the world, and always at risk to one's reputation, because this was seen, as Wilbur Wright said, as the standard of impossibility, the way we would look at somebody who said they wanted to investigate time travel today. It was just seen as physically, scientifically impossible. But Langley went after this and achieved quite a bit by making large, unmanned, but large, winged machines fly through the air under steam power in the mid-1890s. And this did give a greater measure of legitimacy to all of the all experimenters.
In 1896, actually, Langley was having some successful trials with these unmanned powered gliders. They were called aerodromes. Elaborate on them. What were? Tell us more about them.
Well, they looked like these aerodromes were about 15 feet long, wingspan of about the same, two sets of wings, one set fore, one set aft. They looked like big dragonflies, and they were launched by a catapult from the top of a houseboat over the Potomac River. This received a fair amount of publicity, and it became clear that these flights, which were in some cases up to a mile, were about the largest accomplishments that had ever been made in this field. And so people like Wilbur Wright, when they learned about them, and other experimenters too, it helped to sort of give them the bug, thinking that perhaps manned flight would be possible. And of course, the one who had the bug for manned flight more than anyone else was Langley himself. Quite soon after these flights in 1896, he established contacts with the U.S. War Department right on the eve of the Spanish-American War. And he was given a major contract to build a manned flyer as a tool of reconnaissance. So this sort of upped the pressure on Langley to really make this happen.
How would you describe Langley's personality?
Oh, Langley was a very formidable character. He came from a patrician family in Boston. He was the descendant of Puritans and carried himself with a kind of dignified, even pompous air. When he would walk around the halls of the Smithsonian, if he had assistants with him, he always wanted them to walk a few paces behind him. On the other hand, I found in studying his letters, going through his materials, that there was a sympathetic quality to him also. One starts to feel sorry for Langley after a while, the person of such enormous ambitions, a lonely figure. He was not married. He had a few close friends in the scientific community in Washington whom he treasured and who all spoke very highly of him. And these are important people. Alexander Graham Bell was his closest friend. He was friends with John Wesley Powell, the explorer of the Grand Canyon. And these people meant a lot to Langley. And you could see him yearning to have the same kind of a prominence of a Bell or a Powell or an Edison. And wanting it so badly, and yet as you see him go through failure after failure in these experiments, my heart went out to him in spite of myself.
The Wright brothers and Langley had different philosophies in their approach to what would make a machine fly. Wilbur felt that you need balance to be able to steer the machine. Langley chose to put his priority on the idea of power. you know, get the right engine and we can get this thing to fly. What was it that led the Wright brothers to pursue their philosophy?
The image in Wilbur Wright's mind was of a bird. A bird that is able to achieve flight by taking off at a place and time of its own choosing, by going where it wants to and staying balanced despite the wind and turbulence in the air, and coming back safely to the ground wherever it chooses to come down. That's flight. Langley, on the other hand, had in mind the image of an arrow shot through the air or a rock thrown through the air. His chief worry was about putting enough propulsion behind the object to keep it moving. He knew that, balance and equilibrium would be a problem, but he kept postponing the problem of really wrestling with that. He couldn't figure it out. He had some of the same glimpses of insight that Wilbur Wright had had about changing the angles of the wings to keep balance, but he never pursued it. And so Wilbur and then Orville together were honing in on precisely the right problem. And by focusing on that over a period of 4 years, they were able to solve it. And they had been right about the existence of light internal combustion engines. They didn't need a fancy engine to propel this thing. Once they solved the problems of lift and balance and control, they had a working airplane. Langley got stuck on this problem of propulsion, and that's what killed him.
How hard was it for Langley to develop that engine of sufficient power?
This became the albatross around Langley's neck. He hired a young engineer straight out of Cornell, hadn't even graduated, named Charles Manley, who became his chief assistant and chief engineer. Langley didn't know a lot about engines. The two of them thought that they could hire a prominent automotive engineer named Balzer in New York City to build this engine quickly, but Balzer struggled for months and months and months beyond his deadline and never could produce. So the job went to Manley. And a job that was supposed to take just a few months turned into a job of 4 years. It wasn't until 1903 that they felt they had this engine really ready to go for trials. And that's just the engine. They had to deal with the problem of the aerodrome itself, which they kept having failures with also. It's a testament to scientific endurance to read these notebooks.
October 7th, 1903. Samuel Langley and Charles Manley, who acted as pilot, test fly the aerodrome. Describe what happened that day.
There were press all around. Reporters from Washington had conceived a terrific dislike for both Langley and Manley, who handled them in very sort of arrogant, haughty ways. And so these reporters were really swarming. And in the middle of that, you know, reporters in rowboats out in the Potomac, they launched this thing and it went straight down into the water. One of the reporters said it flew like a handful of mortar. So this was cause for sort of hilarious articles in the Washington press, even the national press. There was a lot of coverage. But Langley and Manley were convinced that it had not been a problem with the aerodrome itself, but with a little tiny piece on the catapult. And so they thought they were being treated extremely unfairly, and they were determined to have another trial.
Were the Wrights aware of Langley's failure?
Yes, the Wrights were not far away, just down in North Carolina, at Kitty Hawk, preparing to make their own first powered trials. The Outer Banks at that time was an extremely remote place, really a wilderness, so they didn't sound like they were getting a daily newspaper. But they did get mail, and they had a couple of friends and family in Dayton who were keeping them apprised of what Langley was up to, and they had a clipping about Langley's first failure. And Wilbur said in a letter back home, "I see that Langley has had his try and failed, and now I wonder what our luck will be."
December 8th, 1903, Langley and Manley tried again. What happened?
Well, the weather was much worse, and there was ice in the river even. Langley was determined. He was running out of this. He had run out of money from the War Department. He believed that he had to have one more trial before winter set in to have any prayer of getting more money out of the War Department. And so he and Manley decided on one more trial. Once again, the houseboat goes out, the boat's all around. Manley tries, and the catapult is tripped. This time, the aerodrome goes straight up into the air for a couple of yards and then crashes straight back down on its back end. Manley, in both trials, is trapped underneath and has to swim out from underneath. Obviously, Langley had made no provision for this thing coming down safely. Manley's life was at risk in each of these trials. So this was really the end of Langley's experiments. He was humiliated. He was made fun of in Congress. And he was to die only 3 years later. And his friends said it was of a broken heart. He died of a stroke, but there's not much question that his resolution, his sense of destiny, it was totally shattered in that last trial.
9 days after Langley's disaster, December 17th, 1903, Wright brothers are ready. So tell us about the day of that flight at Kitty Hawk.
Well, they knew that Langley had failed, and so they were even more determined to have this one go. There were only a few people in the area. They were not actually at the village of Kitty Hawk, which was a tiny place itself, but 4 miles south at a place called Kill Devil Hills, where these large sand dunes rise up, good for gliders. There's a life-saving station nearby. And on December 14th, they figured they were finally ready for a trial. They tossed the coin to see who would go first, and Wilbur won the toss. This is the first time they had tried this particular machine. It had the same kind of controls as the most successful glider they had built the year before, but it was a bigger machine, heavier, and so it was all new. And Wilbur flubbed the controls and came to the ground after just a few feet. They busted a couple of pieces, and they went back into their shop to work on those and fix them. So they were ready again, and the weather was good enough on the morning of December 17th. Because of the coin toss, it was Orville's turn. They raised a warning flag to let the lifesavers over at the station a little ways away know that it was time to come over and give them a hand. So a few of these guys ran over. And one of them, a fellow named John Daniels, they asked to take a picture. The Wrights were good photographers and careful to record everything on film. So Daniels got the job of trying to take a picture of this thing. It was about 10:15 in the morning, and the wind was right, and so they set up their launch rail, not down a hill this time, but on the level. They tripped the engine, and Orville was ready to go, and it raced along this warning rail and just barely rose off the ground, a little higher, a little higher. Daniels snapped the photo at precisely the right time. He said afterward he wasn't even sure he had done it. He was so excited to see the thing get off the ground. And the machine pulled away from Wilbur, who was running along at the right-hand side. A terrifically wonderful photograph that shows this exact moment. There was a lot of dipping and bobbing as he went along. It went only 120 feet. But as they said later, this was the first time that a flying machine had lifted itself off the ground under its own steam, come down at a place at least as high as the place from which it had started. So this was technically the first manned flight in history. There had been a few people who had gotten off the ground in little tiny hops before, but this was the promise of true flight. And in fact, it's really the fourth flight of that day that we ought to remember more clearly than that first 12-second flight, although that was the very first. Because Wilbur, in his second try, they both made two tries, Wilbur flew for 59 seconds, 852 feet. That was a much more impressive feat. And it was the one that really convinced them that this machine could actually fly and that they had done what they set out to do.
James Tobin. He's the author of To Conquer the Air, published by the Free Press. Incidentally, the story of the Langley Aerodrome didn't end with its crash into the Potomac. Much to the Wright brothers' chagrin, it was resurrected years later in a different episode in The Race for Flight. We'll have that story in a future installment of our series. For more information on the Wright brothers and Samuel Langley, and to see photos of his great aerodrome and the Wright Flyer in action, go to our website at npr.org.